This is Law and Disorder.
Today on Law and Disorder, we'll have an update on how the University of Illinois rescinded its job offer to Professor Stephen Salaita.
Once again, we're joined by Professor Catherine Franke. Her recent letter to the Chancellor talks about free speech, but also about the suppression of speech about Israel and Palestine.
Middle East correspondent Patrick Coburn joins us to discuss his new book, The Jihadis Return, ISIS and the New Sunni Uprising.
ISIS may have been a surprise for much of us in the West, but it was no surprise for this remarkable journalist, Patrick Coburn, and his remarkable book.
Stay with us.
I'm New York City attorney and author Michael Smith.
I'm Heidi Boghossian, executive director of the A.J. Mustey Memorial Institute.
And I'm Michael Ratner, president emeritus of the Center for Constitutional Rights.
Michael Ratner, Chairman Abbas of the Palestinian Authority is now saying that they want to join the International Criminal Court. What is that about, and why now?
Yes, again, Abbas is threatening to join the International Criminal Court on behalf of the Palestinians. He did put a condition on it. He's saying he won't do it if Israel starts negotiating from the point of the pre-1967 borders. In other words, before Israel took all of the occupied land in the West Bank, Gaza, Golan Heights, etc. And if they're willing to start negotiations with the understanding that the pre-1967 borders are the borders of Palestine and Israel, Abbas will refrain from the Palestinian Authority's acquisition or signing of the treaty with the International Criminal Court. Well, who knows what's going to happen? But one thing it always raises with me is how important is the International Criminal Court? Why is it such a threat that Abbas is making? Why are the United States and Israel both very upset about it? The United States says things like this has to happen during negotiations with the other side. It's not for the court to decide these kind of questions. The last time this was threatened, and when Abbas actually joined 15 other UN conventions, broke off the negotiations. I mean, he may have broken them off for 100 other reasons, but that's the reason he gave. So the question in my mind is, why is the ICC such a threat to Israel and the United States, really, because it's backing Israel? Or is it really just being put out there without it being such a threat? First, I want people to understand, what is the ICC? It's the International Criminal Court, and it has been in existence maybe 10 or so years. And it investigates three sets of crimes: genocide, crimes against humanity, which is the mass killing of civilians, and war crimes, which includes everything from disproportionate use of force, targeting civilians, and when I'll get to the transfer of civilians from your own territory into occupied territory, which is, of course, the settlements. And that's a war crime.
So, now, Michael, what clout does it have?
Well, that's what we're going to. It's obviously seen as a big threat by Israel. Whether a real threat or not, I would have trouble saying. But let's talk about what the court's done, and you can make up your own mind about it. So it investigates these three crimes. 122 countries have joined it. It can only investigate crimes on the territory of someone who's joined the court. So if the Palestinian state joins the court, it can investigate crimes in the occupied territories committed by Israel. And of course, it could also investigate crimes of Hamas, although Israel is not a signatory to the court. Hamas is shooting rockets from its own country, and that would then be subject to the jurisdiction of the court. So that's the ICC. Now, there's another international court, not to mix everybody up, called the ICJ. That's the International Court of Justice. And that has actually taken a Palestinian case many years ago, and that was a case on the wall, and whether it was legal for Israel to build the wall, particularly because it encroached into the occupied territories. And the court, in a really important and historic decision, ruled 14-1, to the extent the wall went into the occupied territories of the West Bank, it was an illegal wall. So they did win a case a number of years ago in the International Court of Justice at The Hague. That's not a criminal case. It's actually against Israel itself. Israel was supposedly forced to comply with it, but of course they only complied with it to the smallest little bit. It went to the Israeli Supreme Court, et cetera. It got mucked around. So that court judgment is out there, but not being complied with, as is obvious from the incursions of the wall into the occupied territories. The ICC, on the other hand, International Criminal Court, has jurisdiction only over individuals. What happens is, if Palestine joins, then they would refer the matter of what crimes were committed in Gaza to the court, and the court would then investigate, or could investigate, open an investigation, and determine whether any, what individuals or which individuals are responsible, get them indicted, get international arrest warrants out, etc. Now, let's say a couple of drawbacks or a couple of problems here. One is, once you accede to the court, sign the convention, which Palestine would do, is it can only, the court can only investigate crimes that occur after you join the court.
So it's not retroactive.
Exactly right, Heidi, which means that the slaughter we just saw in Gaza would not be considered by the court. There's an argument that it should be, but the court has rejected that argument, and that's one of the reasons Palestine went to the Security Council and got named as a member, as a non-observer state rather than a non-observer entity. That happened in 2012. That's what allows Palestine to now go to the court. So here you have Abbas holding this threat over Israel, and it, for starters, it can only investigate crimes once they join, assuming they join. But there are crimes that are ongoing that they could actually investigate, one of the crimes being a war crime, and that's the crime of taking civilians from your country and putting them into the occupied territories. That is a war crime. That's continuing. And not only is it continuing, right after the war, Israel announced the biggest annexation of Palestinian land in 30 years, which is some 1,000 acres in the West Bank, just south of Jerusalem, in what's called the Etzion Block, 1,000 acres. They also announced the permitting of some 1,400 new apartments in the West Bank. So there is an ongoing crime that the court, the ICC, International Criminal Court, could investigate, which would be a big threat to Israel. Now, here's the problem. This is already a very politicized issue, particularly in the West, which tries to block anything or any accountability of Israel. U.S. consistently vetoes resolutions in the United Nations Security Council about settlements, every single one that would might hold Israel accountable. I'm putting that context in because we have to look at what this court has done in the years it's been in existence. It's indicted 36 people. That's a very low number, but it's still 36. One problem is every single person it's indicted is from Africa. Every single one. It's opened 8 investigations. Every investigation is in Africa.
Why the focus on Africa?
Well, the focus is because none of the big powers care very much about going after some dictator in Africa. They care a lot about regions close to China or regions close to Russia or close to the United States. So they go after the weakest link. And so the prospects of there being a serious investigation of Israel, well, let me step back. Palestine has to join, which even that they've made conditional at this point. Assuming they join, which is not clear at all, but assuming they do, then a preliminary investigation has to be opened, then a formal investigation, then an indictment. Many years pass by.
Right.
Now, I should say the court has opened preliminary investigations. They opened one recently about UK war crimes in Iraq. They opened one about a more formal one, perhaps around Colombia and the murders in Colombia. But none of those resulted in indictments. So if you ask yourself about this threat, which is the question you ask me, how serious is this to Israel? Yeah, I mean, they might get a preliminary investigation out of it. Will there ever be an Israeli soldier in the dock in the ICC? Not until we have a very different world, Heidi. It's sort of hard for me to understand how they haven't done this, Palestine. I mean, it doesn't show, I'm not the Palestinian president or chairman. It's hard for me to speak that, but it doesn't seem like such a great step to do it. Mm-hmm. They've signed up 15 other treaties. Why wouldn't they do this? But it's also not a panacea for what's going on between Israel and Palestine. That's for sure, not with a biased court like that. But Israel, as we've noticed from the coverage, fights every single effort to do any accountability tooth and nail. They don't care if it's, me talking on the street corner and suppressing me at my college or Abbas joining the criminal court. So it's been out there. Everybody's writing about it. One article I would recommend, it explains a lot. It's in a magazine called The Link. It's at Link Archives. It's www.ameu.org. and it's published by Americans for Middle East Understanding, and it's titled, Can Palestine Bring Israeli Officials Before the International Criminal Court? It's by John Quigley. Very, very informative article. He's argued before the court on this issue 3 or 4 years ago about the fact that Palestine should have been considered a state back then. The court refused to acknowledge that. Now it's clear they are a state, and so it's only a question of will they join the court. But then it's a lot of questions about will the court ever undertake really looking at an Israeli official.
Thanks for that overview, Michael. Michael, in a few minutes, we'll be talking with Catherine Franke from Columbia University about the incidents happening at the University of Illinois. She references some Freedom of Information Act documents. What happened with those?
Well, two batches came out, one batch 2 weeks ago and one batch last week. The batch last week was some 400 pages requested by numerous reporters, and they were quite extraordinary because when you go through them carefully, as Corey Robin, the Brooklyn political science professor, on his blog, and they really are quite extraordinary because they tell the story of what happened at the University of Illinois. Well, it turns out that Chancellor Wise, the person that made the decision and fired Professor Saleta, initially stood up for the principle of freedom of speech. And we have in those documents correspondence between her and her assistant, the assistant chancellor, who made a public statement saying that we at the University of Illinois support freedom of speech. But then we find further in the documents that there were all kinds of calls and letters being made to Chancellor Wise from important six-figure financial donors to the university. One of them, in fact, endowed a chair in the business school and had just given $500,000. That man is also on the National Board of Hillel, which is kind of a campus support group for the policies of the Israeli government and doesn't allow anybody to criticize those policies and walk through their doors. In any case, this man and others succeeded in rallying so much support from donors who then pressured the University of Illinois, the documents show, that the initial decision to support free speech at the University of Illinois was overridden. Chancellor Wise then, without consultation with the faculty, without consultation with the department that initially hired Professor Saleta, or the dean of the School of Arts and Sciences, just on her own, wrote Saleta saying, you're fired. What she said really was a technicality that we're not going to submit your name to the Board of Trustees, but that's a rubber stamp. The practice at the University of Illinois, it's a sloppy practice, but nonetheless, the rubber stamp is they submit the name. But Saleta was told to order books. He prepared a syllabus. He was given the times his classes would start. He gave up his home. He moved his family. He put down a deposit on a new apartment in Champaign-Urbana. He was ready to go.
He was fired.
And he was fired. And in fact, the American Association of University Professors, the main group of professors in America, going all the way back to 1940 when it was formed by a number of professors, including the famous John Dewey, which has upheld academic freedom since 1940, they wrote a very strong letter to Chancellor Wise on the due process, the fairness doctrine, because he was out on a limb, Professor Saleta, and they cut it off.
And in fact, as Catherine will talk about a little bit in our interview with her, several other scholars across the country have pulled out of talks that they've agreed, among them Alan Isaacman from the University of Minnesota and David Blacker, a professor of philosophy and legal studies at the University of Delaware. So I think we're going to see a trend of people protesting this.
I agree with you. What's happened so far is extraordinary. It's never happened, in my knowledge, in the American Academy. As a consequence of the initial letter that Professor Catherine Franke wrote, over 3,000 professors have declared that they will not engage with the University of Illinois.
It's nearly 4,000,
until gets his job
Michael.
Back.
Right.
Is it up to 4,000?
It's 3,800 as of this taping. Hopefully it will grow. And there were also over 17,000 signers on a change.org petition.
You know, I think the reason for it is that this is really a shot across the bow of every graduate student, every young professor in the country. Because if they can monitor your social media, as we know they do, and they can fire you because of what you say out of the classroom.
Right.
It so chills freedom of speech and freedom of thought and political action that, well, it's like when they had Professor Judith Butler come to Brooklyn College 6 months ago, and there was a big fight about that. And Mayor Bloomberg, to his credit, came down on the side of free speech at Brooklyn, and he said, if you want to go to a university where the government controls what you're going to be taught, then I suggest you enroll in a university in North Korea. And that's the direction that the University of Illinois is going at now, and people know it. And the protest against it has just been extraordinary.
Well, shame on the university, but kudos to all the protesters.
It's, to me, another example of what Gibbons said in his great 18th century book about the decline and fall of the Roman Empire. And the three of us talked about this 10 years ago when they started the war in Iraq. And we said, well, this is going to have terrible consequences against democracy here at home. And then we saw Guantanamo and torture going after civil liberties and so on. You can't have democracy at home and have imperialism abroad. And the United States supports Israel, this sub-imperialist country. That's bounced back because the supporters of the policies of the Israeli government, which are nothing less than a massacre in Gaza, that's bouncing back to us now. And you have supporters like this $500,000 donor to the University of Illinois silencing professors at the University of Illinois. So we've got to bounce back from the policies of Israel over there to our free speech here at home.
Last month, the University of Illinois rescinded its job offer to Professor Stephen Saleta, who wrote social media posts criticizing the war in Gaza. This raised serious concerns under established principles of academic freedom. Professor Saleta was dehired from the American Indian Studies program at the University of Illinois at Urbana-Champaign because of his statements on social media criticizing Israel's conduct of military operations in Gaza. Weeks ago, we reported on Law and Disorder that scholars from law schools across the country came out with strong letters condemning the decision of the university to dehire Saleta. Today, we're joined once again by Catherine Franke, professor of law at Columbia University, for an update on this case.
Catherine Franke, welcome to Law and Disorder again.
Oh, it's nice to be back. Thanks, Michael.
Yeah, it's good to talk to you, Catherine. Let me ask you just some basic questions initially, and that is, who is Professor Saleta? What happened to him, and what's at stake here?
Well, Professor Stephen Saleta, until recently, was a tenured professor at Virginia Tech, and he was well known in English departments across the country, but also among scholars who worked in colonialism and post-colonial studies. And he had developed a really rich body of work thinking about Native American rights, Native people's rights in the United States, and connecting them to Palestinian rights in particular internationally. And he was a well sought after scholar and was hired by the University of Illinois in their American Indian Studies program in a process that started last fall. The department unanimously voted him an offer, and really, I think it was this summer, the university started to get pressure from outside donors, some of their alums and other advocacy groups, to not finalize the offer because of some tweets that Professor Saleta had sent out over the summer related to the Israeli attacks in Gaza. And just yesterday, actually, some of those emails to the university chancellor were released showing that large six-figure donors to the university had seen those tweets or learned of them and said, you cannot hire this guy or I will withdraw all my future giving to the university. So the chancellor let Stephen know in August that she was not going to finalize his offer, even though they'd already negotiated his teaching schedule. He'd already rented an apartment. They'd already negotiated his moving expenses. So he was under the clear impression that he had had a final offer from the university.
Catherine, hadn't he also quit his former job?
Yeah, of course. He had resigned his former position and accepted this one at the University of Illinois in Urbana-Champaign. So he right now has no job, no income, nowhere to live, and no real prospect of where his life is going next.
Catherine, the larger issues, what's at stake here? This seems to me to be the most important academic freedom, free speech issue to come down in recent times.
Well, it's the most recent iteration of what has been a rather well-organized, well-financed campaign in the United States in particular to purge the academy of scholars and even graduate students who are doing work that is either sympathetic to the idea of Palestinian sovereignty or rights or critical of Israeli state policy, particularly the occupation. And what we're seeing here is some ways it's an accident that it was Professor Salida who got picked this summer. It could have been any number of other scholars. But the organized lobby that has been pushing very hard to purge these sorts of voices from the academy picked him out. He's not the first, and unfortunately he won't be the last, I'm afraid, scholar who's been targeted in this way. And we've seen quite a lot of it at Columbia University, I must confess.
But Catherine, this campaign, doesn't it represent one of the largest national campaigns around the firing of a pro-Palestinian professor? We've seen success in terms of the boycotts.
Well, I think that's right. It's mobilized people this summer, and I think they were already somewhat mobilized by their shared outrage about the real murder of children and others in Gaza as part of the Israelis' Operation Protective Edge. So people were already talking to one another and wanting to do something about the Israeli assaults on the Gazans, and then this broke. And it was so obviously a violation of a fundamental principle of academic freedom and really handled so badly by the university that it galvanized a lot of people to come to Professor Salida's defense. Like myself, people who really never knew him before. So I've only learned of his scholarship as a result of this campaign and his termination from the University of Illinois.
And you've written a wonderful letter dated September 2nd to Dr. Phyllis Weiss, the chancellor of the University of Illinois at Urbana-Champaign. Could you tell us about that letter?
Well, there's been a request by the faculty at the University of Illinois and by Professor Salida, but more importantly from USACBI, the campaign to support Palestinian rights and support the boycott, that academics not go to the University of Illinois and speak or participate in university-sponsored events until this matter was resolved. And I had been invited last summer, I think it was June, to give several talks at the University of Illinois, just coincidentally, and had agreed to do it. And then this event happened, and I thought, well, I really, in good conscience, can't, certainly. But more importantly, I think the boycott is only the beginning of where one's political commitment should rest. In a way, Michael Ratner and I were talking about this even yesterday. We've entered a period of what I call hashtag political activism, where people push a button on their computer. They like something on Facebook or they circulate a hashtag at very little expense to themselves. And that kind of political engagement requires very little commitment. So while I endorse the boycott, the academic boycott now of the University of Illinois, I also think we need to think critically about other ways to engage the injustice that triggered the boycott in the first place. And I explained that to Chancellor Weiss in the letter I sent, that not only will I not come to the university in an official capacity to speak there, but I will come to Urbana-Champaign and meet off-campus with faculty and students and other interested members of the community about these issues of academic freedom, but even more importantly, about the issues the problematic tweets, were gesturing towards in 190 characters.
Columbia Law Professor Catherine Franke, you wrote in your letter to Chancellor Wise, who was responsible for getting Professor Salaita fired, you wrote that her reasons for it were both disingenuous and disheartening. And although she says that she is for academic freedom, she says that Stephen Salaita was uncivil. You took that issue on. Could you explain to us what you meant by disingenuous and disheartening?
Well, I think it's disingenuous on the level of her prepared statement and then the prepared statement by the chair of the Board of Trustees, Chris Kennedy, in troubling ways mirror the kind of rhetoric that the David Project and other right-wing Zionist projects have been undertaking in the last few years to purge the university of critical voices like Professor Salaita's. And their strategy has been to portray any criticism of Israeli state policy or any criticism of political Zionism as uncivil or as a form of hate speech, but more importantly, to appeal to a civility norm, that it's not nice, and that it creates an unwelcome learning environment for students, particularly Jewish students. So to see her parroting that language and for the for Chris Kennedy to parrot that language says to me that they've been reached by these organized operatives from the outside about how to message this termination. I don't believe that there's really a civility norm at stake here, and I actually think we shouldn't have one in a university setting. We ought to take on uncivil ideas, ideas that are troubling, that are uncomfortable, and unpack them in thoughtful, scholarly ways. But we shouldn't be afraid of ideas that are unusual, that are uncomfortable, and that might unsettle some of our more familiar ways of thinking about hard problems.
Chris Kennedy, of course, is the chairman of the Board of Trustees at the University of Illinois, a wealthy man, the head of the Merchandise Mart in Chicago. I want to ask you a question about their strategy in defending this, because it seems to me that their position was carefully and cleverly crafted with the consultation with attorneys to come out with the formulation that they are for free speech, but they're just against incivility. Do you think that that kind of argument has a chance in the courts?
Well, these types of cases, tenure cases, are difficult to win for those who were challenging the denial of tenure. A termination, I think, is a little easier. But this case raises some very difficult questions about the relevance of an academic's statements in his personal capacity on social media to his suitability in the classroom, to his temperament in the classroom. And I've been talking to a number of Stephen's former students who all say he entertains and welcomes a diverse set of ideas in the classroom. So the appeal to civility shifts on the part of the university, shifts the question away from a litmus test around a difficult question like notions of belonging and rights and violence in the Middle East. And I think it's a more difficult question for courts to get involved in that they may want to stay away from determining what's civil and what's not civil, and defer to a university and their judgment on that question. And so I do think it's a smart legal strategy on the part of the university, but as these emails are coming out through Freedom of Information Act requests over the last few days, it's quite clear that civility is not what underwrote the decision to terminate him. It was really outside pressure from donors who held a particular perspective on political Zionism that they thought was antithetical to Stephen Salaita's employment there.
Catherine, this is Michael Ratner, and I know we promised not to keep you any longer than we have already. I just want you to close with something about where is the situation right now, where is the case, and is there anywhere publicly right now that people can go and look at this amazing letter you wrote to the Chancellor of University of Illinois?
Well, the case, I know Stephen's lawyers are negotiating with the university, and they've been fairly unhappy with the kind of offer that offers that the university has made. The university's pretty dug in right now. They have another board of directors, board of trustees meeting September 11th. We don't know in what capacity this catastrophe will be brought to the board, if at all. It's very possible that they will bring Stephen's appointment to the board so that they can formally reject it to give the chancellor cover, or they may just leave it where it is now. But I would be pretty surprised if the the Board of Trustees decided to vote favorably for his appointment, given the kind of dug-in legal position they've taken. But I'd love to be surprised on that. And the letter I wrote is on Columbia's website, certainly not the law school's website, but Corey Robin has put it up on his website, his blog. And I'll also send the link to you, and you can post it on the Law and Disorder website.
Great. Catherine Franke, thank you very much. It's really, the work you've done on this is really remarkable and bringing it into the broader context.
Yeah, well, it's my great pleasure to talk to all of you.
I agree. This is an ongoing fight. Chris Kennedy said something to the effect that we don't want the guy around here. We're willing to throw some money at him. We'll be checking back with you because I think that this is a big one and an ongoing one. Thanks so much for being on Law and Disorder.
Thank you, Catherine.
Oh, you're very welcome. Take care.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Visit us online at lawanddisorder.org for archived programs and links to many of the issues we discuss.
Last week, the United States sent 350 more troops to Iraq, even after Obama said, no more boots on the ground. Last June, America carried out airstrikes to stop the advance of the Islamic State of Iraq and the Levant, known as ISIS, into the Kurdish capital of Erbil. A more complicated situation has developed in Syria. The U.S. Western European, Saudi, and Arab Gulf policy is to overthrow Syrian President Bashar al-Assad, which is also the goal of ISIS. And now the United States finds itself under the doctrine, the enemy of my enemy is my friend, in alliance with Assad. We talked today with the best Western reporter at work in Iraq today, Patrick Coburn, about his new book, The Jihadi's Return, ISIS and the New Sunni Uprising. We'll also talk about the role of Saudi Arabia and the funding of Sunni terrorist groups, which was exposed by WikiLeaks. Patrick Coburn is currently the Middle East correspondent for The Independent and has worked previously for the Financial Times.
Patrick, welcome to Law and Disorder.
Thank you.
You've written a remarkable book, and for many people in this country, we'd never heard of ISIS until a few weeks ago. Tell us what it is.
The Islamic State of Iraq and the Levant, or al-Sham, which has turned into the new caliphate in western northern Iraq and eastern Syria. It has come out of al-Qaeda in Iraq, this organization which was linked to al-Qaeda but wasn't formed by al-Qaeda after the U.S. invasion of Iraq in 2003, is very anti-Shia, is a Sunni fundamentalist, is extremely violent. In ideology, it's close to al-Qaeda. But what makes it so effective is it's a mixture of religious fanaticism and military efficiency.
Yeah, I think you mentioned in the book, with regard to its military efficiency, that it's a number of its people came out of Iraq, and with the overthrow of Saddam Hussein, didn't have a place to go. Is that, you said something like that, I think.
Yes, there's a little bit of uncertainty about this. Some of the senior people of ISIS are former security officers and special Republican Guard officers from Saddam Hussein's time. But bear in mind that the record of Saddam's army was not great. I think there's another factor which is perhaps more important, which is that ISIS is led by a core of people who fought the U.S. in Iraq, fought the Iraqi army. This is after 2003, and then after 2011 fought in Syria. So it's quite an experienced group, and if you survive those wars, you're probably fairly good at what you do.
Were you surprised when ISIS swept, or at least we put it in the West and the U.S., swept into Iraq from Syria? Was that a surprise to you that they just took Mosul like that, et cetera?
It didn't quite happen like that. I mean, it had been growing stronger in Iraq over the last 3 years. It had launched a series of campaigns, one of which was to break its members out of prison. It had taken over quite big territory in Iraq. Then it had moved into Syria. It used its experienced fighters. It used its money. Had got big in Syria. Then in this year, it was moving back into Iraq. I mean, it was present in both countries, but its main effort was in Iraq this year when it took over Fallujah, much of Anbar province in western Iraq. And it always had strength in Mosul city, even when the Iraqi army was theoretically in charge, but it would still levy protection money on people, maybe $8 million a month. I know businessmen who were paying for big contracts there, were paying half a million dollars a month to ISIS. Its final takeover, yes, was pretty surprising that it was so swift and so devastating. I can't think of an example in history when, and there were 350,000 men in the Iraqi army, 650,000 police, simply disintegrated under an attack from probably 1,000, 3,000 ISIS fighters.
Patrick, you would have to say that, you know, now that they control an area the size of Great Britain, what a debacle for American foreign policy. How do you explain what American foreign policy did wrong to come up with this?
Well, I think the most important recent thing that they got very wrong was that, you know, everything now is being blamed on the dysfunctional Iraqi government under Prime Minister Nouri al-Maliki, who is still Prime Minister, although he's about to step down. And a lot of this is true. It was an extraordinarily corrupt, kleptocratic government. But what really changed was in 2011, when you had the uprising in Syria, primarily of the Sunni Arabs in Syria. And Iraqi politicians have been saying to me the last 3 years, if this goes on in Syria, if the war against to displace Assad goes on, then it will inevitably destabilize Iraq, that it will spread from the Sunni in Syria to the Sunni in Iraq. And that's really what happened. And the U.S. and its allies were, to a substantial degree, responsible for this. They backed the uprising against Assad. And even when it was apparent, really, over the last 2 years that Assad wasn't going to go, he still controlled 13 out of 14 Syrian provincial capitals, the only negotiated settlement they'd look at was displacement of Assad. And this, in fact, was a recipe for the war going on. I think they just didn't see what was happening. I mean, I mentioned this to senior diplomats, and they'd say, oh, it's all exaggerated, this idea that what is happening in Syria will spread to Iraq. But they were wrong.
Patrick, your book is titled The Jihadis Return, ISIS and the New Sunni Uprising. I wanted to ask you, what is Wahhabism?
Wahhabism is the Islamic variant practiced in Saudi Arabia. There's always been an alliance over the last 200 or 300 years between the preachers of this very puritanical, fanatical, violent, and bigoted variant of Islam and the House of Saud. What they believe is not that much different from what ISIS believes. And it's very anti-Shia. The Shia are seen as heretics, worthy of death. It is anti-Christian, anti-Jewish, and deeply intolerant.
You spend some time in the book discussing Wahhabism, Saudi Arabia, Pakistan, and basically, the way I read it is saying the U.S. went after the wrong people after 9/11. Can you explain that?
Absolutely. I mean, you know, without the policies of Saudi Arabia and Pakistan, there wouldn't have been a 9/11. It's notorious that the 15 out of the 19 hijackers were Saudis. The leader, bin Laden, was part of the Saudi elite. The money for 9/11 came primarily from private donors in Saudi Arabia, according to the U.S. Official inquiry. But rather amazingly, after 9/11, the Saudis were let off scot-free. Saudis were let out of the U.S. The focus was on Iraq and Afghanistan, but never on Pakistan, who are the main backers of the Taliban, and without the complicity, or at least the tolerance, of the Pakistan military intelligence, bin Laden couldn't have operated in Afghanistan.
One thing you mention in here, because I represent Julian Assange and WikiLeaks, you refer to a WikiLeaks cable that's relevant to what you're saying, particularly on Saudi Arabia, that says that Hillary Clinton wrote that Saudi Arabia remains a critical financial support base for al-Qaeda, the Taliban, etc. So that was interesting to me. But the other question I have on that is, in addition to those countries, Pakistan, Saudi Arabia, you mentioned some other countries that have played what I would have to say is a nefarious role in terms of support for, broadly stating, the jihadists. What are some of those, and are they there's still that support going
Kuwait
on?
Kuwait has been a major financial supporter of the jihadis. So has UAE, so has Qatar, the Gulf monarchies as a whole, if you like. And so has Turkey. Without the border between Turkey and Syria being opened, and Turkey being used as a sanctuary by the jihadis, they couldn't have become as powerful as they have become. Probably now, since they control their own territory, they aren't quite so reliant on Turkey. But this was absolutely vital for them.
You also mentioned four wars in the book, and I thought that was really telling, because we bandy these about here, saying, well, the U.S. shouldn't have intervened, but of course each of them had either a dictator or a group that the U.S. or we felt engaged in human rights violations, was a dictatorship, and that's Iraq, Afghanistan, Libya, and Syria. And You say in your book that U.S. or Western intervention exacerbated the situations and that may have brought us to where we are today. Can you explain that?
Yes. I mean, these interventions that started off with a big sort of roll of drums and were meant to improve the conditions, let's say, of people in Libya. And Libya had been run by Gaddafi with his personality cult. But look at Libya today. You know, it's descended into anarchy. The airport's been destroyed. Export of oil, even, is limited now. Afghanistan, Iraq, all these countries in general, the situation for much of the population has got worse.
Would you conclude from those examples that, therefore, the United States should take its hands off and leave these people to their own devices?
Broadly speaking, yes. I mean, you can, in certain cases, you know, and people have justified foreign intervention. But, I mean, my view is that countries that intervene and occupy others act in their own interests. This shouldn't be too surprising. One thing that was very noticeable in Iraq, and I spent much of my time there since 2003, is that the U.S. acted in its own interest. It appointed leaders in its own interest. It was the U.S. that originally appointed Maliki. Even the destruction of the Iraqi army, which just disintegrated, I asked a four-star Iraqi general a few weeks ago why he was just retired. Why had the army collapsed? And he said, well, corruption, corruption, corruption. He said it started off because the U.S. insisted that the supplies for the Iraqi army be outsourced to private companies. As a consequence, you'd have, let's say, a battalion nominally of 600 men, but in fact had only 200, but food would be paid for 600. And so any commander in the Iraqi army could make a great deal of money through these means. Consequently, it was in their interest to have as few soldiers as possible. When Mosul fell in northern Iraq, it's reckoned that about only 1 in 3 of Iraqi soldiers were actually in the barracks. Most of them stayed at home and were giving kickbacks to stay at home. So you ended up with an army which was more of a racket than an army.
You know, Patrick, things seem in a difficult situation now, and I'm interested in what you think about the announcement by President Obama, not only with regard to the bombing he's doing in Iraq, perhaps something may happen in Syria as well, but I think they're going to put some, quote, advisors in, 350 or something like that. And, of course, you address in the book with, I wouldn't say pessimism isn't a word I use about a reporter, but at least you see it as a very odd, this is going to go on for a long time. But what do you think of Obama's proposals? And I know you're not a leader of a country, but do you have any of your own?
Well, I think, you know, Obama is being cautious, and there's every reason to be cautious. Look what happened on previous times that the U.S. intervened in Iraq and Afghanistan. So, you know, a lot of the criticism of Obama by Hillary Clinton, by the Republicans, has no real validity. I think the problem for Obama and the U.S. is they have to sort of decide which side they're on. In Iraq, they're supporting the government against ISIS. They're supporting the Kurds against ISIS. But in Syria, the main opponent of ISIS is the Assad government. But the U.S. policy is to weaken and displace that government. So in a way, it's acting in the same way as ISIS. I don't mean it's in a conspiracy with them, but it has a completely, its policy actually assists them. So it will have to decide, you know, what its attitude is to Assad. Is it still trying to get rid of him? Now, of course, there are those who will say, but the U.S. is going to be supporting moderate opposition in Syria. But if you're actually on the ground, there is no real moderate opposition, or it's weak and getting weaker. You know, this is a pretense that Senator McCain and others have put forward. So I think there's a sort of lack of realism, and that's been much to the benefit of ISIS, that it can sort of shift backwards and forwards between Iraq and Syria. So they have to decide what they're going to do.
It's interesting. The West went full out, it seemed to me, or almost full out from my perspective, on Syria. You know, Free Syrian Army, the UK, where you are, I think, essentially almost allowed hundreds of people from the UK to go into Syria fighting against Assad. They were pushing out Assad as this is a black and white situation. We got to get rid of him. And was there ever a point where there was really a Free Syrian Army that was not going to be taken over or was already part of the jihadist in some way that they couldn't control it? I mean, was there ever a point where anything positive could have come out of that?
I'm not sure there was. You know, in 2011, you did have a sort of moderate opposition against the dictatorship in Damascus. It was, which is extremely brutal, and those it was also had some aspects of a social revolution of impoverished people in the countryside against the rich of the cities and the Iraqi security service, which was the main basis for the regime. But quite quickly, the opposition was taken over by jihadis, backed by Saudi Arabia and Qatar. I mean, there was always a contradiction in U.S. and European policy that they sort of pretended that they wanted to establish a secular democracy in Syria, likewise in Libya. But they were, in order to establish this secular democracy, their big allies, the people who provided all the money, which purchased the weapons, were Saudi Arabia and Qatar and the others, that are the only theocratic absolute monarchies on earth. And the last thing these people wanted was the establishment of a secular democracy.
We're speaking with Patrick Coburn, the author of the new book, The Jihadi's Return, ISIS and the New Sunni Uprising. And Patrick, what struck me in the book was your description about how the ISIS, in all the territory and the many millions of people that it has control over, is providing all sorts of services, as well as dealing with the oil there. And I remember when we were so outraged at America's intention before they invaded Iraq, and they initially called it over here, they called it Operation Iraqi Liberation, and then they realized that that spelled oil, so they changed the name of it. So my question to you, is it still all about oil, or to what extent is it about oil, and who's got the oil?
Well, overall, oil is at the center of what happens in the Middle East. You know, I think most people understand, you know, that if the biggest product of Iraq was dates or asparagus or something, there wouldn't be so much interest abroad. You know, there isn't the same interest even in Latin America or Africa. It's oil that makes the difference in this region. More specifically, who has the oil at the moment? Well, the Shia of Iraq, the government in Baghdad, controls the great oil fields of the south. But in Syria, ISIS has taken over its own oil fields. Most of the Syrian oil fields, it's selling that crude, so it's sort of self-financing now. It's taken over some smaller oil fields in Iraq. One thing that I think is seldom spoken about, that it could disrupt Iraqi oil production in general, that the oil fields in the south are very vulnerable to the type of guerrilla warfare, the sort of armed columns that ISIS specializes in using on the battlefield.
Patrick, we're running out of time. I just want to, again, talk about your book for a second. It's The Jihadis Return, ISIS and the New Sunni Uprising. It's spectacular and really interesting for all of us who know very little, particularly compared to you. But thank you again, Patrick Coburn, for being with us.
And well, to thank OR Books for publishing it. Patrick, thank you so much. Every success with this book. People should read it. This is the most important book to come out about this subject. It really is necessary to read it.
Very elegantly written. Thank you, Patrick.
Thank you so much.
If you want to hear Law and Disorder again, go to lawanddisorder.org on the web. You should also go to Law and Disorder Radio on Facebook.
Thank you.